had never told it. She felt proud to know that he was an honored professor in Berlin, though only a poor language master in America, and his homely, hard-working life was much beautified by the spice of romance which this discovery gave it. Another and a better gift than intellect was shown her in a most unexpected manner. Miss Norton had the entree into most society, which Joe would have had no chance of seeing but for her. The solitary woman felt an interest in the ambitious girl, and kindly conferred many favors of this sort, both on Joe and the professor. She took them with her one night to a select symposium held in honor of several celebrities. Joe went prepared to bow down and adore the mighty ones, whom she had worshipped with youthful enthusiasm afar off. But her reverence for genius received a severe shock that night, and it took her some time to recover from the discovery that the great creatures were only men and women after all. Imagine her dismay on stealing a glance of timid admiration at the poet whose line suggested an ethereal being fed on spirit, fire, and dew, to behold him devouring his supper with an ardor which flushed his intellectual countenance. Turning as from a fallen idol, she made other discoveries which rapidly dispelled her romantic illusions. The great novelist vibrated between two decanters with the regularity of a pendulum. The famous divine flirted openly with one of the Madame de Stael's of the age, who looked daggers at another Corinne, who was amiably satirizing her, after outmaneuvering her in efforts to absorb the profound philosopher, who imbibed tea Johnsonianly, and appeared to slumber, the loquacity of the lady rendering speech impossible. The scientific celebrities, forgetting their mollusks in glacial periods, gossiped about art, while devoting themselves to oysters and ices with characteristic energy. The young musician, who was charming the city like a second Orpheus, talked horses, and the specimen of the British nobility present happened to be the most ordinary man of the party. Before the evening was half over, Joe felt so completely disillusioned that she sat down in a corner to recover herself. Mr. Bayer soon joined her, looking rather out of his element, and presently several of the philosophers, each mounted on his hobby, came ambling up to hold an intellectual tournament in the recess. The conversations were miles beyond Joe's comprehension, but she enjoyed it, though Kant and Hegel were unknown gods, the subjective and objective unintelligible terms, and the only thing evolved from her inner consciousness was a bad headache after it was all over. It dawned upon her gradually that the world was being picked to pieces and put together on new and, according to the talkers, on infinitely better principles than before, that religion was in a fair way to be reasoned into nothingness, and intellect was to be the only god. Joe knew nothing about philosophy or metaphysics of any sort, but a curious excitement, half pleasurable, half painful, came over her as she listened, with a sense of being turned adrift into time and space, like a young balloon out on a holiday. She looked around to see how the professor liked it, and found him looking at her with the grimmest expression she had ever seen him wear. He shook his head and beckoned her to come away, but she was fascinated just then by the freedom of speculative philosophy and kept her seat, trying to find out what the wise gentleman intended to rely upon after they had annihilated all the old beliefs. Now, Mr. Bayer was a diffident man and slow to offer his own opinions, not because they were unsettled, but too sincere and earnest to be lightly spoken. As he glanced from Joe to several other young people, attracted by the brilliancy of the philosophic pyrotechnics, he knit his brows and longed to speak, fearing that some inflammable young soul would be led astray by the rockets, to find, when the display was over, that they had only an empty stick or a scorched hand. He bore it as long as he could, but when he was appealed to for an opinion, he blazed up with honest indignation and defended religion with all the eloquence of truth, an eloquence which made his broken English musical and his plain face beautiful. He had a hard fight, for the wise men argued well, but he didn't know when he was beaten and stood to his colors like a man. Somehow, as he talked, the world got right again to Joe. The old beliefs that had lasted so long seemed better than the new. God was not a blind force, and immortality was not a pretty fable, but a blessed fact. She felt as if she had solid ground under her feet again, and when Mr. Bayer paused, out-talked but not one whit convinced, Joe wanted to clap her hands and thank him. She did neither, but she remembered the scene and gave the professor her heartiest respect, for she knew it cost him an effort to speak out then and there, because his conscience would not let him be silent. She began to see that character is a better possession than money, rank, intellect, or beauty, and to feel that if greatness is what a wise man has defined it to be, truth, reverence, and goodwill, then her friend, Friedrich Bayer, was not only good, but great. This belief strengthened daily. She valued his esteem, she coveted his respect, she wanted to be worthy of his friendship, and just when the wish was sincerest, she came near to losing everything. It all grew out of a cocked hat, for one evening the professor came in to give Joe her lesson with a paper soldier cap on his head, which Tina had put there and he'd forgotten to take off. "It's evident he doesn't look in his glass before coming down," thought Joe with a smile, as he said, "Good evening," and sat soberly down, quite unconscious of the ludicrous contrast between his subject and his headgear, for he was going to read her The Death of Wallenstein. She said nothing at first, for she liked to hear him laugh out his big, hearty laugh when anything funny happened, so she left him to discover it for himself, and presently forgot all about it, for to hear a German read Schiller is rather an absorbing occupation. After the reading came the lesson, which was a lively one, for Joe was in a gay mood that night, and the cocked hat kept her eyes dancing with merriment. The professor didn't know what to make of her, and stopped at last to ask with an air of mild surprise that was irresistible. "Miss March, for what do you laugh in your master's face? Have you no respect for me that you go on so bad?" "How can I be respectful, sir, when you forget to take your hat off?" said Joe. Lifting his hand to his head, the absent-minded professor gravely felt and removed the little cocked hat, looked at it a minute, and then threw back his head and laughed like a merry bass viol. "Ah, I see him now. It is that imp Tina who makes me a fool with my cap. Well, it is nothing, but see you, if this lesson goes not well, you too shall wear him." But the lesson did not go at all for a few minutes, because Mr. Bayer caught sight of a picture on the hat, and unfolding it, said with great disgust, "I wish these papers did not come in the house. They are not for children to see, nor young people to read. It is not well, and I have no patience with those who make this harm." Joe glanced at the sheet and saw a pleasing illustration composed of a lunatic, a corpse, a villain, and a viper. She did not like it, but the impulse that made her turn it over was not one of displeasure, but fear, because for a minute she fancied the paper was the volcano. It was not, however, and her panic subsided, as she remembered that, even if it had been, and one of her own tales in it, there would have been no name to betray her. She had betrayed herself, however, by a look and a blush, for though an absent man, the professor saw a good deal more than people fancied. He knew that Joe wrote and had met her down among the newspaper offices more than once, but as she never spoke of it, he asked no questions in spite of a strong desire to see her work. Now it occurred to him that she was doing what she was ashamed to own, and it troubled him. He did not say to himself, "It is none of my business, I've no right to say anything," as many people would have done. He only remembered that she was young and poor, a girl far away from mother's love and father's care, and he was moved to help her with an impulse as quick and natural as that which would prompt him to put out his hand to save a baby from a puddle. All this flashed through his mind in a minute, but not a trace of it appeared in his face, and by the time the paper was turned and Joe's needle threaded, he was ready to say, quite naturally, but very gravely, "Yes, you're right to put it from you. I do not think that good young girls should see such things. They are made pleasant to some, but I would more rather give my boys gunpowder to play with than this bad trash." "All may not be bad, only silly, you know, and if there is a demand for it, I don't see any harm in supplying it. Many very respectable people make an honest living out of what are called sensation stories," said Joe, scratching gathers so energetically that a row of little slits followed her pen. "There is a demand for whiskey, but I think you and I do not care to sell it. If the respectable people knew what harm they did, they would not feel that the living was honest. They have no right to put poison in the sugar plum and let the small ones eat it. No, they should think a little and sweep mud in the street before they do this thing." Mr. Bayer spoke warmly and walked to the fire, crumpling the paper in his hands. Joe sat still, looking as if the fire had come to her, for her cheeks burned long after the cocked hat had turned to smoke and gone harmlessly up the chimney. "I should like much to send all the rest after him," muttered the professor, coming back with a relieved air. Joe thought what a blaze her pile of papers upstairs would make, and her hard-earned money lay rather heavily on her conscience at that minute. Then she thought consolingly to herself, "Mine are not like that. They are only silly, never bad, so I won't be worried." And taking up her book, she said, with a studious face, "Shall we go on, sir? I'll be very good and proper now."
"I shall hope so," was all he said,
but he meant more than she imagined, and the grave, kind look he gave her made her feel as if the words "Weekly Volcano" were printed in large type on her forehead. As soon as she went to her room, she got out her papers and carefully reread every one of her stories. Being a little short-sighted, Mr. Bear sometimes used eyeglasses, and Jo had tried them once, smiling to see how they magnified the fine print of her book. Now she seemed to have on the professor's mental or moral spectacles also, for the faults of these poor stories glared at her dreadfully and filled her with dismay. "They are trash, and will soon be worse trash if I go on, for each is more sensational than the last. I've gone blindly on, hurting myself and other people, for the sake of money. I know it's so, for I can't read this stuff in sober earnest without being horribly ashamed of it, and what should I do if they were seen at home, or Mr. Bear got hold of them?" Jo turned hot at the bear idea and stuffed the whole bundle into her stove, nearly setting the chimney afire with the blaze. "Yes, that's the best place for such inflammable nonsense. I'd better burn the house down, I suppose, than let other people blow themselves up with my gunpowder," she thought, as she watched the demon of the Jura whisk away, a little black cinder with fiery eyes. But when nothing remained of all her 3 months' work except a heap of ashes and the money in her lap, Jo looked sober as she sat on the floor, wondering what she ought to do about her wages. "I think I haven't done much harm yet, and may keep this to pay for my time," she said, after a long meditation, adding impatiently, "I almost wish I hadn't any conscience, it's so inconvenient. If I didn't care about doing right and didn't feel uncomfortable when doing wrong, I should get on capitally. I can't help wishing sometimes that mother and father hadn't been so particular about such things." Ah, Jo, instead of wishing that, thank God that father and mother were particular, and pity from your heart those who have no such guardians to hedge them round with principles, which may seem like prison walls to impatient youth, but which will prove sure foundations to build character upon in womanhood. Jo wrote no more sensational stories, deciding that the money did not pay for her share of the sensation, but going to the other extreme, as is the way with people of her stamp, she took a course of Mrs. Sherwood, Miss Edgeworth, and Hannah Moore, and then produced a tale which might have been more properly called an essay or a sermon, so intensely moral was it. She had her doubts about it from the beginning, for her lively fancy and girlish romance felt as ill at ease in the new style as she would have done masquerading in the stiff and cumbrous costume of the last century. She sent this didactic gem to several markets, but it found no purchaser, and she was inclined to agree with Mr. Dashwood that morals didn't sell. Then she tried a child story, which she could easily have disposed of if she had not been mercenary enough to demand filthy lucre for it. The only person who offered enough to make it worth her while to try juvenile literature was a worthy gentleman who felt it his mission to convert all the world to his particular belief. But much as she liked to write for children, Jo could not consent to depict all her naughty boys as being eaten by bears or tossed by mad bulls because they did not go to a particular Sabbath school, nor all the good infants who did go as rewarded by every kind of bliss, from gilded gingerbread to escorts of angels when they departed this life with psalms or sermons on their lisping tongues. So nothing came of these trials, and Jo corked up her inkstand and said in a fit of very wholesome humility, "I don't know anything. I'll wait until I do before I try again, and meantime sweep mud in the street if I can't do better. That's honest, at least." Which decision proved that her second tumble down the beanstalk had done her some good. While these internal revolutions were going on, her external life had been as busy and uneventful as usual, and if she sometimes looked serious or a little sad, no one observed it but Professor Bayer. He did it so quietly that Jo never knew he was watching to see if she would accept and profit by his reproof, but she stood the test, and he was satisfied, for though no words passed between them, he knew that she had given up writing. Not only did he guess it by the fact that the second finger of her right hand was no longer inky, but she spent her evenings downstairs now, was met no more among newspaper offices, and studied with a dogged patience, which assured him that she was bent on occupying her mind with something useful, if not pleasant. He helped her in many ways, proving himself a true friend, and Jo was happy, for while her pen lay idle, she was learning other lessons besides German and laying a foundation for the sensation story of her own life. It was a pleasant winter and a long one, for she did not leave Mrs. Kirker till June. Everyone seemed sorry when the time came. The children were inconsolable, and Mr. Bayer's hair stuck straight up all over his head, for he always rumpled it wildly when disturbed in mind.
"Going home? Ah, you are happy that you have a home to go in," he said when she told him, and sat silently pulling his beard in the corner while she held a little levee on that last evening. She was going early, so she bade them all goodbye overnight, and when his turn came, she said warmly, "Now, sir, you won't forget to come and see us if you ever travel our way, will you? I'll never forgive you if you do, for I want them all to know my friend."
"Do you? Shall I come?"
he asked, looking down at her with an eager expression which she did not see. "Yes, come next month. Lori graduates then, and you'd enjoy commencement as something new."
"That is your best friend of whom you speak?" he said in an altered tone.
"Yes, my boy Teddy. I'm very proud of him, and should like you to see him." Jo looked up then, quite unconscious of anything but her own pleasure in the prospect of showing them to one another. Something in Mr. Bayer's face suddenly recalled the fact that she might find Lori more than a best friend, and simply because she particularly wished not to look as if anything was the matter, she involuntarily began to blush, and the more she tried not to, the redder she grew. If it had not been for Tina on her knee, she didn't know what would have become of her. Fortunately, the child was moved to hug her, so she managed to hide her face an instant, hoping the professor did not see it. But he did, and his own changed again from that momentary anxiety to its usual expression, as he said cordially,
"I fear I shall not make the time for that, but I wish the friend much success and you all happiness. God bless you."
And with that, he shook hands warmly, shouldered Tina, and went away. But after the boys were abed, he sat long before his fire with the tired look on his face and the heimweh, or homesickness, lying heavy at his heart. Once, when he remembered Jo as she sat with the little child in her lap and that new softness in her face, he leaned his head on his hands a minute and then roamed about the room, as if in search of something that he could not find.
"It is not for me. I must not hope it now," he said to himself, with a sigh that was almost a groan.
Then, as if reproaching himself for the longing that he could not repress, he went and kissed the two tousled heads upon the pillow, took down his seldom-used meerschaum, and opened his Plato. He did his best and did it manfully, but I don't think he found that a pair of rampant boys, a pipe, or even the divine Plato, were very satisfactory substitutes for wife and child at home. Early as it was, he was at the station next morning to see Jo off, and thanks to him, she began her solitary journey with the pleasant memory of a familiar face, smiling its farewell, a bunch of violets to keep her company, and best of all, the happy thought, "Well, the winter's gone and I've written no books, earned no fortune, but I've made a friend worth having, and I'll try to keep him all my life." Chapter 35. Heartache. Whatever his motive might have been, Lori studied to some purpose that year, for he graduated with honor and gave the Latin oration with the grace of a Phillips and the eloquence of a Demosthenes, so his friends said. They were all there, his grandfather, oh, so proud, Mr. and Mrs. March, John and Meg, Joe and Beth, and all exulted over him with a sincere admiration, which boys make light of at the time, but fail to win from the world by any after triumphs.
"I've got to stay for this confounded supper, but I shall be home early tomorrow. You'll come and meet me as usual, girls?" Lori said, as he put the sisters into the carriage after the joys of the day were over. He said girls, but he meant Jo, for she was the only one who kept up the old custom. She had not the heart to refuse her splendid, successful boy anything, and answered warmly,
"I'll come, Teddy, rain or shine, and march before you playing Hail, the Conquering Hero Comes, on a Jew's harp." Lori thanked her with a look that made her think in a sudden panic. "Oh, dearie me, I know he'll say something, and then what shall I do?" Evening meditation and morning work somewhat allayed her fears, and having decided that she wouldn't be vain enough to think people were going to propose when she'd given them every reason to know what her answer would be, she set forth at the appointed time, hoping Teddy wouldn't do anything to make her hurt his poor feelings. A call at Meg's and a refreshing sniff and sip at the Daisy and Demijohn still further fortified her for the tête-à-tête. But when she saw a stalwart figure looming in the distance, she had a strong desire to turn about and run away.
"Where's the jew's harp, Joe?" cried Laurie, as soon as he was within speaking distance.
"I forgot it." And Joe took heart again, for that salutation could not be called lover-like. She always used to take his arm on these occasions. Now she did not, and he made no complaint, which was a bad sign, but talked on rapidly about all sorts of faraway subjects, till they turned from the road into the little path that led homeward through the grove. Then he walked more slowly, suddenly lost his fine flow of language, and now and then a dreadful pause occurred. To rescue the conversation from one of the wells of silence into which it kept falling, Joe said hastily, "Now, you must have a good long holiday."
"I intend to."
Something in his resolute tone made Joe look up quickly, to find him looking down at her with an expression that assured her the dreaded moment had come, and made her put out her hand with an imploring, "No, Teddy, please don't."
"I will, and you must hear me. It's no use, Joe. We've got to have it out, and the sooner the better for both of us," he answered, getting flushed and excited all at once.
"Say what you like, then. I'll listen," said Joe, with a desperate sort of patience. Laurie was a young lover, but he was in earnest and meant to have it out, if he died in the attempt, so he plunged into the subject with characteristic impetuosity, saying in a voice that would get choky now and then, in spite of manful efforts to keep it steady,
"I've loved you ever since I've known you, Joe. Couldn't help it. You've been so good to me. I've tried to show it, but you wouldn't let me. Now I'm going to make you hear and give me an answer, for I can't go on so any longer."
"I wanted to save you this. I thought you'd understand," began Joe, finding it a great deal harder than she expected.
"I know you did, but the girls are so queer you never know what they mean. They say no when they mean yes and drive a man out of his wits just for the fun of it," returned Laurie,
entrenching himself behind an undeniable fact.
"I don't. I never wanted to make you care for me so, and I went away to keep you from it if I could."
"I thought so. It was like you, but it was no use. I only loved you all the more, and I worked hard to please you, and I gave up billiards and everything you didn't like, and waited and never complained, for I hoped you'd love me, though I'm not half good enough."
Here there was a choke that couldn't be controlled, so he decapitated buttercups while he cleared his confounded throat.
You're a great deal too good for me, and I'm so grateful to you, and so proud and fond of you. I don't know why I can't love you as you want me to. I've tried, but I can't change the feeling, and it would be a lie to say I do when I don't."
"Really? Truly, Joe?"
He stopped short and caught both her hands as he put his question with a look that she did not soon forget.
"Really, truly, dear?"
They were in the grove now, close by the stile, and when the last words fell reluctantly from Joe's lips, Laurie dropped her hands and turned, as if to go on. But for once in his life, the fence was too much for him. So he just laid his head down on the mossy post and stood so still that Joe was frightened.
"Oh, Teddy, I'm sorry. So desperately sorry. I could kill myself if it would do any good. I wish you wouldn't take it so hard. I can't help it. You know it's impossible for people to make themselves love other people if they don't," cried Joe,
inelegantly but remorsefully, as she softly patted his shoulder, remembering the time when he had comforted her so long ago.
"They do sometimes," said a muffled voice from the post.
"I don't believe it's the right sort of love, and I'd rather not try it," was the decided answer.
There was a long pause while a blackbird sung blithely on the willow by the river, and the tall grass rustled in the wind. Presently, Joe said very soberly, as she sat down on the step of the stile,
"Laurie, I want to tell you something."
He started as if he had been shot, threw up his head, and cried out in a fierce tone,
"Don't tell me that, Joe. I can't bear it now."
"Tell what?" she asked, wondering at his violence.
"That you love that old man."
"What old man?" demanded Joe, thinking he must mean his grandfather.
That devilish professor you were always writing about. If you say you love him, I know I shall do something desperate.
And he looked as if he would keep his word, as he clenched his hands with a wrathful spark in his eyes. Jo wanted to laugh, but restrained herself and said warmly, for she too was getting excited with all this,
"Don't swear, Teddy. He isn't old nor anything bad, but good and kind, and the best friend I've got, next to you. Pray don't fly into a passion. I want to be kind, but I know I shall get angry if you abuse my professor. I haven't the least idea of loving him or anybody else."
"But you will after a while, and then what will become of me?"
"You'll love someone else, too, like a sensible boy, and forget all this trouble."
"I can't love anyone else, and I'll never forget you, Joe. Never, never,"
with a stamp to emphasize his passionate words.
"What shall I do with him?" sighed Joe, finding that emotions were more unmanageable than she expected. "You haven't heard what I wanted to tell you. Sit down and listen, for indeed I want to do right and make you happy," she said, hoping to soothe him with a little reason, which proved that she knew nothing about love. Seeing a ray of hope in that last speech, Lori threw himself down on the grass at her feet, leaned his arm on the lower step of the stile, and looked up at her with an expectant face. Now, that arrangement was not conducive to calm speech or clear thought on Joe's part, for how could she say hard things to her boy while he watched her with eyes full of love and longing and lashes still wet with the bitter drop or two her hardness of heart had wrung from him? She gently turned his head away, saying, as she stroked the wavy hair, which had been allowed to grow for her sake, how touching that was, to be sure. "I agree with Mother that you and I are not suited to each other, because our quick tempers and strong wills would probably make us very miserable, if we were so foolish as to..." Joe paused a little over the last word, but Lori uttered it with a rapturous expression.
"Mary, no, we shouldn't. If you loved me, Joe, I should be a perfect saint, for you could make me anything you like."
"No, I can't. I've tried and failed, and I won't risk our happiness by such a serious experiment. We don't agree, and we never shall, so we'll be good friends all our lives, but we won't go and do anything rash."
"Yes, we will if we get the chance," muttered Lori rebelliously.
"Now, do be reasonable and take a sensible view of the case," implored Joe, almost at her wit's end.
"I won't be reasonable. I don't want to take what you call a sensible view. It won't help me, and it only makes it harder. I don't believe you've got any heart."
"I wish I hadn't." There was a little quiver in Joe's voice, and thinking it a good omen, Lori turned round, bringing all his persuasive powers to bear, as he said, in the wheedlesome tone that had never been so dangerously wheedlesome before.
"Don't disappoint us, dear. Everyone expects it. Grandpa has set his heart upon it. Your people like it, and I can't get on without you. Say you will, and let's be happy. Do, do."
Not until months afterward did Joe understand how she had the strength of mind to hold fast to the resolution she had made when she decided that she did not love her boy, and never could. It was very hard to do, but she did it, knowing that delay was both useless and cruel.
"I can't say yes truly, so I won't say it at all. You'll see that I'm right by and by, and thank me for it," she began solemnly.
"I'll be hanged if I do."
And Lori bounced up off the grass, burning with indignation at the very idea.
"Yes, you will," persisted Joe. "You'll get over this after a while and find some lovely, accomplished girl who will adore you and make a fine mistress for your fine house. I shouldn't. I'm homely and awkward and odd and old, and you'd be ashamed of me, and we should quarrel. We can't help it even now, you see, and I shouldn't like elegant society, and you would, and you'd hate my scribbling, and I couldn't get on without it, and we should be unhappy and wish we hadn't done it, and everything would be horrid."
"Anything more?" asked Lori,
finding it hard to listen patiently to this prophetic burst.
"Nothing more, except that I don't believe I shall ever marry. I'm happy as I am, and love my liberty too well to be in a hurry to give it up for any mortal man."
"I know better," broke in Lori. "You think so now, but there'll come a time when you will care for somebody, and you'll love him tremendously, and live and die for him. I know you will. It's your way, and I shall have to stand by and see it."
And the despairing lover cast his hat upon the ground with a gesture that would have seemed comical if his face had not been so tragic.
Yes, I will live and die for him, if he ever comes and makes me love him, in spite of myself, and you must do the best you can, cried Joe, losing patience with poor Teddy. I've done my best, but you won't be reasonable, and it's selfish of you to keep teasing for what I can't give. I shall always be fond of you, very fond indeed, as a friend, but I'll never marry you, and the sooner you believe it, the better for both of us. So now.
That speech was like gunpowder. Laurie looked at her a minute, as if he did not quite know what to do with himself, then turned sharply away, saying in a desperate sort of tone,
You'll be sorry some day, Joe.
Oh, where are you going? She cried, for his face frightened her.
To the devil, was the consoling answer.
For a minute, Joe's heart stood still, as he swung himself down the bank toward the river. But it takes much folly, sin, or misery to send a young man to a violent death, and Laurie was not one of the weak sort who are conquered by a single failure. He had no thought of a melodramatic plunge, but some blind instinct led him to fling hat and coat into his boat and row away with all his might, making better time up the river than he had done in any race. Joe drew a long breath and unclasped her hands as she watched the poor fellow trying to outstrip the trouble which he carried in his heart.
That will do him good, and he'll come home in such a tender, penitent state of mind that I shan't dare to see him, she said, adding as she went slowly home, feeling as if she had murdered some innocent thing and buried it under the leaves. Now I must go and prepare Mr. Lawrence to be very kind to my poor boy. I wish he'd love Beth. Perhaps he may in time, but I begin to think I was mistaken about her. Oh, dear, how can girls like to have lovers and refuse them? I think it's dreadful.
Being sure that no one could do it so well as herself, she went straight to Mr. Lawrence, told the hard story bravely through, and then broke down, crying so dismally over her own insensibility that the kind old gentleman, though sorely disappointed, did not utter a reproach. He found it difficult to understand how any girl could help loving Laurie, and hoped she would change her mind, but he knew even better than Joe that love cannot be forced. So he shook his head sadly and resolved to carry his boy out of harm's way, for young impetuosity's parting words to Joe disturbed him more than he would confess. When Laurie came home, dead tired but quite composed, his grandfather met him as if he knew nothing, and kept up the delusion very successfully for an hour or two. But when they sat together in the twilight, the time they used to enjoy so much, it was hard work for the old man to ramble on as usual, and harder still for the young one to listen to praises of the last year's success, which to him now seemed like love's labor lost. He bore it as long as he could, then went to his piano and began to play. The windows were open, and Joe, walking in the garden with Beth, for once understood music better than her sister, for he played the sonata pathétique, and played it as he never did before.
"That's very fine, I dare say, but it's sad enough to make one cry. Give us something gayer, lad," said Mr. Lawrence, whose kind old heart was full of sympathy, which he longed to show, but knew not how.
Laurie dashed into a livelier strain, played stormily for several minutes, and would have got through bravely if, in a momentary lull, Mrs. March's voice had not been heard calling,
"Joe, dear, come in. I want you."
Just what Laurie longed to say, with a different meaning. As he listened, he lost his place. The music ended with a broken chord, and the musician sat silent in the dark.
"I can't stand this," muttered the old gentleman.
Up he got, groped his way to the piano, laid a kind hand on either of the broad shoulders, and said, as gently as a woman,
"I know, my boy, I know."
No answer for an instant. Then Laurie asked sharply,
"Who told you?"
"Joe herself."
"Then there's an end of it."
And he shook off his grandfather's hands with an impatient motion, for though grateful for the sympathy, his man's pride could not bear a man's pity.
"Not quite. I want to say one thing, and then there shall be an end of it," returned Mr. Lawrence with unusual mildness. "You won't care to stay at home now, perhaps." "I don't intend to run away from a girl. Joe can't prevent my seeing her, and I shall stay and do it as long as I like," interrupted Laurie in a defiant tone. "Not if you are the gentleman I think you. I'm disappointed, but the girl can't help it, and the only thing left for you to do is to go away for a time. Where will you go?"
"Anywhere.
I don't care what becomes of me. And Lori got up with a reckless laugh that grated on his grandfather's ear.
Take it like a man and don't do anything rash, for God's sake. Why not go abroad as you planned and forget it?
I can't.
But you've been wild to go, and I promised you should when you got through college.
But I didn't mean to go alone.
And Lori walked fast through the room with an expression which it was well his grandfather did not see.
I don't ask you to go alone. There's someone ready and glad to go with you anywhere in the world.
Who, sir?
Stopping to listen.
Myself.
Lori came back as quickly as he went and put out his hand, saying huskily,
I'm a selfish brute, but, you know, grandfather.
Lord help me, yes, I do know, for I've been through it all before, once in my own young days, and then with your father. Now, my dear boy, just sit quietly down and hear my plan. It's all settled and can be carried out at once, said Mr. Lawrence,
keeping hold of the young man, as if fearful that he would break away, as his father had done before him.
Well, sir, what is it?
And Lori sat down, without a sign of interest in face or voice.
There is business in London that needs looking after. I meant you should attend to it, but I can do it better myself, and things here will get on very well with Brooke to manage them. My partners do almost everything. I'm merely holding on until you take my place and can be off at any time.
But you hate traveling, sir. I can't ask it of you at your age,
began Lori, who was grateful for the sacrifice, but much preferred to go alone if he went at all. The old gentleman knew that perfectly well, and particularly desired to prevent it, for the mood in which he found his grandson assured him that it would not be wise to leave him to his own devices. So, stifling a natural regret at the thought of the home comforts he would leave behind him, he said stoutly,
Bless your soul, I'm not superannuated yet. I quite enjoy the idea. It will do me good, and my old bones won't suffer, for traveling nowadays is almost as easy as sitting in a chair.
A restless movement from Lori suggested that his chair was not easy, or that he did not like the plan, and made the old man add hastily,
I don't mean to be a marplot or a burden. I go because I think you'd feel happier than if I was left behind. I don't intend to gad about with you, but leave you free to go where you like, while I amuse myself in my own way. I've friends in London and Paris, and should like to visit them. Meantime, you can go to Italy, Germany, Switzerland, where you will, and enjoy pictures, music, scenery, and adventures to your heart's content.
Now, Lori felt just then that his heart was entirely broken, and the world a howling wilderness, but at the sound of certain words which the old gentleman artfully introduced into his closing sentence, the broken heart gave an unexpected leap, and a green oasis or two suddenly appeared in the howling wilderness. He sighed, and then said, in a spiritless tone,
Just as you like, sir. It doesn't matter where I go or what I do. It does to me. Remember that, my lad. I give you entire liberty, but I trust you to make an honest use of it. Promise me that, Lori.
Anything you like, sir.
Good, thought the old gentleman. You don't care now, but there'll come a time when that promise will keep you out of mischief, or I'm much mistaken.
Being an energetic individual, Mr. Lawrence struck while the iron was hot, and before the blighted being recovered spirit enough to rebel, they were off. During the time necessary for preparation, Lori bore himself as young gentlemen usually do in such cases. He was moody, irritable, and pensive by turns, lost his appetite, neglected his dress, and devoted much time to playing tempestuously on his piano, avoided Jo, but consoled himself by staring at her from his window, with the tragic face that haunted her dreams by night and oppressed her with a heavy sense of guilt by day. Unlike some sufferers, he never spoke of his unrequited passion, and would allow no one, not even Mrs. March, to attempt consolation or offer sympathy. On some accounts, this was a relief to his friends, but the weeks before his departure were very uncomfortable, and everyone rejoiced that the poor dear fellow was going away to forget his trouble and come home happy. Of course, he smiled darkly at their delusion, but passed it by with the sad superiority of one who knew that his fidelity, like his love, was unalterable. When the parting came, he affected high spirits, to conceal certain inconvenient emotions which seemed inclined to assert themselves. This gaiety did not impose upon anybody, but they tried to look as if it did, for his sake, and he got on very well, till Mrs. March kissed him, with a whisper full of motherly solicitude. Then, feeling that he was going very fast, he hastily embraced them all round, not forgetting the afflicted Hannah, and ran downstairs as if for his life. Joe followed a minute after to wave her hand to him, if he looked round. He did look round, came back, put his arms about her as she stood on the step above him, and looked up at her, with a face that made his short appeal eloquent and pathetic.
"Oh, Joe, can't you?"
"Teddy, dear, I wish I could." That was all, except a little pause. Then Laurie straightened himself up, said, "It's all right, never mind," and went away without another word. Ah, but it wasn't all right, and Joe did mind, for while the curly head lay on her arm a minute after her hard answer, she felt as if she had stabbed her dearest friend, and when he left her without a look behind him, she knew that the boy, Laurie, never would come again. Chapter 36. Beth's Secret. When Joe came home that spring, she had been struck with a change in Beth. No one spoke of it or seemed aware of it, for it had come too gradually to startle those who saw her daily. But to eyes sharpened by absence, it was very plain, and a heavy weight fell on Joe's heart as she saw her sister's face. It was no paler and but littler thinner than in the autumn, yet there was a strange transparent look about it, as if the mortal was being slowly refined away, and the immortal shining through the frail flesh with an indescribably pathetic beauty. Joe saw and felt it, but said nothing at the time, and soon the first impression lost much of its power, for Beth seemed happy, no one appeared to doubt that she was better, and presently, in other cares, Joe, for a time, forgot her fear. But when Laurie was gone and peace prevailed again, the vague anxiety returned and haunted her. She had confessed her sins and been forgiven, but when she showed her savings and proposed a mountain trip, Beth had thanked her heartily, but begged not to go so far away from home. Another little visit to the seashore would suit her better, and as Grandma could not be prevailed upon to leave the babies, Joe took Beth down to the quiet place, where she could live much in the open air and let the fresh sea breezes blow a little color into her pale cheeks. It was not a fashionable place, but even among the pleasant people there, the girls made few friends, preferring to live for one another. Beth was too shy to enjoy society, and Joe too wrapped up in her to care for anyone else. So they were all in all to each other, and came and went, quite unconscious of the interest they excited in those about them, who watched with sympathetic eyes the strong sister and the feeble one, always together, as if they felt instinctively that a long separation was not far away. They did feel it, yet neither spoke of it, for often between ourselves and those nearest and dearest to us, there exists a reserve which it is very hard to overcome. Joe felt as if a veil had fallen between her heart and Beth's, but when she put out her hand to lift it up, there seemed something sacred in the silence, and she waited for Beth to speak. She wondered, and was thankful also, that her parents did not seem to see what she saw, and during the quiet weeks when the shadows grew so plain to her, she said nothing of it to those at home, believing that it would tell itself when Beth came back no better. She wondered still more if her sister really guessed the hard truth, and what thoughts were passing through her mind during the long hours when she lay on the warm rocks with her head in Joe's lap, while the winds blew healthfully over her and the sea made music at her feet. One day, Beth told her. Joe thought she was asleep, she lay so still, and putting down her book, sat looking at her with wistful eyes, trying to see signs of hope in the faint color on Beth's cheeks. But she could not find enough to satisfy her, for the cheeks were very thin, and the hands seemed too feeble to hold even the rosy little shells they'd been collecting. It came to her then, more bitterly than ever, that Beth was slowly drifting away from her, and her arms instinctively tightened their hold upon the dearest treasure she possessed. For a minute her eyes were too dim for seeing, and when they cleared, Beth was looking up at her so tenderly that there was hardly any need for her to say, "Joe, dear, I'm glad you know it. I've tried to tell you, but I couldn't." There was no answer except her sister's cheek against her own, not even tears, for when most deeply moved, Jo did not cry. She was the weaker then, and Beth tried to comfort and sustain her, with her arms about her and the soothing words she whispered in her ear.
"I've known it for a good while, dear, and now I'm used to it. It isn't hard to think of, or to bear. Try to see it so, and don't be troubled about me, because it's best. Indeed it is."
"Is that what made you so unhappy in the autumn, Beth? You did not feel it then and keep it to yourself so long, did you?" asked Jo, refusing to see or say that it was best, but glad to know that Lori had no part in Beth's trouble.
"Yes, I gave up hoping then, but I didn't like to own it. I tried to think it was a sick fancy and would not let it trouble anyone. But when I saw you all so well and strong and full of happy plans, it was hard to feel that I could never be like you. And then I was miserable, Jo."
"Oh, Beth, and you didn't tell me, didn't let me comfort and help you? How could you shut me out, bear it all alone?"
Jo's voice was full of tender reproach, and her heart ached to think of the solitary struggle that must have gone on while Beth learned to say goodbye to health, love, and life, and take up her cross so cheerfully.
"Perhaps it was wrong, but I tried to do right. I wasn't sure, no one said anything, and I hoped I was mistaken. It would have been selfish to frighten you all when Marmee was so anxious about Meg and Amy away, and you so happy with Lori. At least, I thought so then."
"And I thought you loved him, Beth, and I went away because I couldn't," cried Jo, glad to say all the truth.
Beth looked so amazed at the idea that Jo smiled in spite of her pain and added softly,
"Then you didn't, dearie. I was afraid it was so, and imagined your poor little heart full of lovelornity all that while."
"Why, Jo, how could I, when he was so fond of you?" asked Beth, as innocently as a child. "I do love him dearly. He is so good to me, how can I help it? But he could never be anything to me but my brother. I hope he truly will be, sometime."
"Not through me," said Jo decidedly. "Amy is left for him, and they would suit excellently, but I have no heart for such things now. I don't care what becomes of anybody but you, Beth. You must get well."
"I want to. Oh, so much. I try, but every day I lose a little, and feel more sure that I shall never gain it back. It's like the tide, Jo. When it turns, it goes slowly, but it can't be stopped."
"It shall be stopped. Your tide must not turn so soon. 19 is too young, Beth. I can't let you go. I'll work and pray and fight against it. I'll keep you in spite of everything. There must be ways. It can't be too late. God won't be so cruel as to take you from me," cried poor Jo rebelliously, for her spirit was far less piously submissive than Beth's.
Simple, sincere people seldom speak much of their piety. It shows itself in acts rather than in words, and has more influence than homilies or protestations. Beth could not reason upon or explain the faith that gave her courage and patience to give up life and cheerfully wait for death. Like a confiding child, she asked no questions, but left everything to God and nature, Father and Mother of us all, feeling sure that they, and they only, could teach and strengthen heart and spirit for this life and the life to come. She did not rebuke Jo with saintly speeches, only loved her better for her passionate affection, and clung more closely to the dear human love, from which our Father never means us to be weaned, but through which he draws us closer to himself. She could not say, "I'm glad to go," for life was very sweet for her. She could only sob out,
"I try to be willing,"
while she held fast to Jo, as the first bitter wave of this great sorrow broke over them together. By and by, Beth said, with recovered serenity,
"You'll tell them this when we go home."
"I think they will see it without words," sighed Jo, for now it seemed to her that Beth changed every day.
"Perhaps not. I've heard that the people who love best are often blindest to such things. If they don't see it, you will tell them for me. I don't want any secrets, and it's kinder to prepare them. Meg has John and the babies to comfort her, but you must stand by Father and Mother, won't you, Jo?"
"If I can. But, Beth, I don't give up yet. I'm going to believe that it is a sick fancy and not let you think it's true," said Jo, trying to speak cheerfully.
Beth lay a minute thinking,
and then said in her quiet way, "I don't know how to express myself, and shouldn't try to anyone but you, because I can't speak out except to my Joe. I only mean to say that I have a feeling that it never was intended I should live long. I'm not like the rest of you. I never made any plans about what I do when I grew up. I never thought of being married, as you all did. I couldn't seem to imagine myself anything but stupid little Beth, trotting about at home, of no use anywhere but there. I never wanted to go away, and the hard part now is the leaving you all. I'm not afraid, but it seems as if I should be homesick for you, even in heaven." Joe could not speak, and for several minutes there was no sound but the sigh of the wind and the lapping of the tide. A white-winged gull flew by, with a flash of sunshine on its silvery breast. Beth watched it till it vanished, and her eyes were full of sadness. A little gray-coated sandbird came tripping over the beach, peeping softly to itself, as if enjoying the sun and sea. It came quite close to Beth, and looked at her with a friendly eye, and sat upon a warm stone, dressing its wet feathers, quite at home. Beth smiled and felt comforted, for the tiny thing seemed to offer its small friendship, and remind her that a pleasant world was still to be enjoyed. "Dear little bird, see, Joe, how tame it is. I like peeps better than the gulls. They are not so wild and handsome, but they seem happy, confiding little things. I used to call them my birds last summer, and Mother said they reminded her of me, busy, Quaker-colored creatures, always near the shore, and always chirping that contented little song of theirs. You are the gull, Joe, strong and wild, fond of the storm and the wind, flying far out to sea, and happy all alone. Meg is the turtle dove, and Amy is like the lark she write about, trying to get up among the clouds, but always dropping down into its nest again. Dear little girl, she's so ambitious, but her heart is good and tender, and no matter how high she flies, she never will forget home. I hope I shall see her again, but she seems so far away. She is coming in the spring, and I mean that you shall be all ready to see and enjoy her. I'm going to have you well and rosy by that time," began Joe, feeling that of all the changes in Beth, the talking change was the greatest, for it seemed to cost no effort now, and she thought aloud in a way quite unlike bashful Beth. "Joe, dear, don't hope any more. It won't do any good. I'm sure of that. We won't be miserable, but enjoy being together while we wait. We'll have happy times, for I don't suffer much, and I think the tide will go out easily, if you help me." Joe leaned down to kiss the tranquil face, and with that silent kiss, she dedicated herself, soul and body, to Beth. She was right. There was no need of any words when they got home, for Father and Mother saw plainly now what they'd prayed to be saved from seeing. Tired with her short journey, Beth went at once to bed, saying how glad she was to be home, and when Joe went down, she found that she would be spared the hard task of telling Beth's secret. Her father stood leaning his head on the mantelpiece and did not turn as she came in, but her mother stretched out her arms as if for help, and Joe went to comfort her without a word. Chapter 37. New Impressions. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, all the fashionable world at Nice may be seen on the Promenade des Anglais, a charming place, for the wide walk, bordered with palms, flowers, and tropical shrubs, is bounded on one side by the sea, on the other by the grand drive, lined with hotels and villas, while beyond lie orange orchards and the hills. Many nations are represented, many languages spoken, many costumes worn, and on a sunny day the spectacle is as gay and brilliant as a carnival. Haughty English, lively French, sober Germans, handsome Spaniards, ugly Russians, meek Jews, free and easy Americans, all drive, sit, or saunter here, chatting over the news and criticizing the latest celebrity who has arrived, Ristori or Dickens, Victor Emmanuel, or the Queen of the Sandwich Islands. The equipages are as varied as the company and attract as much attention, especially the low-basket barouches in which ladies drive themselves with a pair of dashing ponies, gay nets to keep their voluminous flounces from overflowing the diminutive vehicles, and little grooms on the perch behind. Along this walk on Christmas Day, a tall young man walked slowly, with his hands behind him and a somewhat absent expression of countenance.
He looked like an Italian, was dressed like an Englishman, and had the independent air of an American, a combination which caused sundry pairs of feminine eyes to look approvingly after him, and sundry dandies in black velvet suits with rose-colored neckties, buff gloves, and orange flowers in their buttonholes to shrug their shoulders and then envy him his inches. There were plenty of pretty faces to admire, but the young man took little notice of them, except a glance now and then at some blonde girl in blue. Presently he strolled out of the promenade and stood a moment at the crossing, as if undecided whether to go and listen to the band in the Jardin Public or to wander along the beach toward Castle Hill. The quick trot of ponies' feet made him look up, as one of the little carriages, containing a single young lady, came rapidly down the street. The lady was young, blonde, and dressed in blue. He stared a minute, then his whole face woke up, and waving his hat like a boy, he hurried forward to meet her.
"Oh, Lori, is it really you? I thought you'd never come," cried Amy, dropping the reins and holding out both hands, to the great scandalization of a French mama, who hastened her daughter's steps, lest she should be demoralized by beholding the free manners of these mad English.
"I was detained, by the way, but I promised to spend Christmas with you, and here I am."
"How is your grandfather? When did you come? Where are you staying?"
"Very well, last night, at the Chauvin. I called at your hotel, but you were out."
"I have so much to say, I don't know where to begin. Get in, and we can talk at our ease. I was going for a drive and longing for company. Flo's saving up for tonight."
"What happens then, a ball?"
"A Christmas party at our hotel. There are many Americans there, and they give it in honor of the day. You'll go with us, of course. Aunt will be charmed."
"Thank you. Where now?" asked
Lori, leaning back and folding his arms, a proceeding which suited Amy, who preferred to drive, for her parasol whip and blue reins over the white ponies' backs afforded her infinite satisfaction.
"I'm going to the banker's first for letters, and then to Castle Hill. The view is so lovely, and I like to feed the peacocks. Have you ever been there?"
"Often, years ago, but I don't mind having a look at it."
"Now tell me all about yourself. The last I heard of you, your grandfather wrote that he expected you from Berlin."
"Yes, I spent a month there and then joined him in Paris, where he is settled for the winter. He has friends there and finds plenty to amuse him, so I go and come, and we got on capitally."
"That's a sociable arrangement," said Amy, missing something in Lori's manner, though she couldn't tell what.
"Why, you see, he hates to travel, and I hate to keep still, so we each suit ourselves, and there is no trouble. I am often with him, and he enjoys my adventures, while I like to feel that someone is glad to see me when I get back from my wanderings. Dirty old hole, isn't it?" he added, with a look of disgust as they drove along the boulevard to the Place Napoleon in the old city.
"The dirt is picturesque, so I don't mind. The river and the hills are delicious, and these glimpses of the narrow cross streets are my delight. Now we shall have to wait for that procession to pass. It's going to the Church of St. John."
While Lori listlessly watched the procession of priests under their canopies, white-veiled nuns bearing lighted tapers, and some brotherhood in blue chanting as they walked, Amy watched him, and felt a new sort of shyness steal over her, for he was changed, and she could not find the merry-faced boy she left in the moody-looking man beside her. He was handsomer than ever, and greatly improved, she thought, but now that the flush of pleasure at meeting her was over, he looked tired and spiritless. Not sick, nor exactly unhappy, but older and graver than a year or two of prosperous life should have made him. She couldn't understand it, and did not venture to ask questions, so she shook her head and touched up her ponies as the procession wound away across the arches of the Paglioni Bridge and vanished in the church.
"Que pensez-vous?" she said, airing her French, which had improved in quantity, if not quality, since she came abroad.
"That mademoiselle has made good use of her time, and the result is charming," replied Lori, bowing with his hand on his heart and an admiring look.
She blushed with pleasure, but somehow the compliment did not satisfy her like the blunt praises he used to give her at home when he promenaded round her on festival occasions and told her she was altogether jolly, with a hearty smile and an approving pat on the head. She didn't like the new tone, for though not blasé, it sounded indifferent in spite of the look.
"If that's the way he's going to grow up, I wish he'd stay a boy," she thought, with a curious sense of disappointment and discomfort,
trying meantime to seem quite easy and gay. At Avigdor's, she found the precious home letters and, giving the reins to Lori, read them luxuriously as they wound up the shady road between green hedges where tea roses bloomed as freshly as in June. "Beth is very poorly," Mother says. "I often think I ought to go home, but they all say stay. So I do, for I shall never have another chance like this," said Amy, looking sober over one page.
"I think you are right there. You could do nothing at home, and it is a great comfort to them to know that you are well and happy and enjoying so much, my dear."
He drew a little nearer and looked more like his old self as he said that, and the fear that sometimes weighed on Amy's heart was lightened, for the look, the act, the brotherly "my dear" seemed to assure her that if any trouble did come, she would not be alone in a strange land. Presently she laughed and showed him a small sketch of Joe in her scribbling suit, with the bow rampantly erect upon her cap, and issuing from her mouth the words, "Genius Burns." Lori smiled, took it, put it in his vest pocket, to keep it from blowing away, and listened with interest to the lively letter Amy read him.
"This will be a regular Merry Christmas to me, with presents in the morning, you and letters in the afternoon, and a party at night," said Amy, as they alighted among the ruins of the old fort, and a flock of splendid peacocks came trooping about them, tamely waiting to be fed. While Amy stood laughing on the bank above him as she scattered crumbs to the brilliant birds, Lori looked at her as she had looked at him, with a natural curiosity to see what changes time and absence had wrought. He found nothing to perplex or disappoint, much to admire and approve, for overlooking a few little affectations of speech and manner, she was as sprightly and graceful as ever, with the addition of that indescribable something in dress and bearing which we call elegance. Always mature for her age, she had gained a certain aplomb in both carriage and conversation, which made her seem more of a woman of the world than she was, but her old petulance now and then showed itself, her strong will still held its own, and her native frankness was unspoiled by foreign polish. Lori did not read all this while he watched her feed the peacocks, but he saw enough to satisfy and interest him, and carried away a pretty little picture of a bright-faced girl standing in the sunshine, which brought out the soft hue of her dress, the fresh color of her cheeks, the golden gloss of her hair, and made her a prominent figure in the pleasant scene. As they came up onto the stone plateau that crowns the hill, Amy waved her hand as if welcoming him to her favorite haunt, and said, pointing here and there, "Do you remember the cathedral and the Corso? The fishermen dragging their nets in the bay, and the lovely road to Villafranca, Schubert's Tower, just below, and best of all, that speck far out to sea which they say is Corsica."
"I remember. It's not much changed," he answered without enthusiasm.
"What Joe would give for a sight of that famous speck," said Amy, feeling in good spirits and anxious to see him so also.
"Yes," was all he said. But he turned and strained his eyes to see the island, which a greater usurper than even Napoleon now made interesting in his sight.
"Take a good look at it for her sake, and then come and tell me what you've been doing with yourself all this while," said Amy, seating herself, ready for good talk. But she did not get it, for though he joined her and answered all her questions freely, she could only learn that he had roved about the continent and been to Greece. So after idling away an hour, they drove home again, and having paid his respects to Mrs. Carroll, Lori left them, promising to return in the evening. It must be recorded of Amy that she deliberately prinked that night. Time and absence had done its work on both the young people. She had seen her old friend in a new light, not as our boy, but as a handsome and agreeable man, and she was conscious of a very natural desire to find favor in his sight. Amy knew her good points and made the most of them with a taste and skill which is a fortune to a poor and pretty woman. Tarleton and tulle were cheap at Nice, so she enveloped herself in them on such occasions, and following the sensible English fashion of simple dress for young girls, got up charming little toilettes with fresh flowers, a few trinkets, and all manner of dainty devices, which were both inexpensive and effective. It must be confessed that the artist sometimes got possession of the woman and indulged in antique coiffures, statuesque attitudes, and classic draperies. But, dear heart, we all have our little weaknesses, and find it easy to pardon such in the young, who satisfy our eyes with their comeliness and keep our hearts merry with their artless vanities. I do want him to think I look well, and tell them so at home, said Amy to herself, as she put on Flo's old white silk ball dress and covered it with a cloud of fresh illusion, out of which her white shoulders and golden head emerged with a most artistic effect. Her hair she had the sense to let alone, after gathering up the thick waves and curls into a Hebe-like knot at the back of her head. "It's not the fashion, but it's becoming, and I can't afford to make a fright of myself," she used to say, when advised a frizzle, puff, or braid, as the latest style commanded. Having no ornaments fine enough for this important occasion, Amy looped her fleecy skirts with rosy clusters of azalea and framed the white shoulders in delicate green vines. Remembering the painted boots, she surveyed her white satin slippers with girlish satisfaction and chassied down the room, admiring her aristocratic feet all by herself. "My new fan just matches my flowers, my gloves fit to a charm, and the real lace on Aunt's mouchoir gives an air to my whole dress. If I only had a classical nose and mouth, I should be perfectly happy," she said, surveying herself with a critical eye and a candle in each hand. In spite of this affliction, she looked unusually gay and graceful as she glided away. She seldom ran. It did not suit her style, she thought, for being tall, the stately and Juno-esque was more appropriate than the sportive or piquant. She walked up and down the long saloon while waiting for Lori, and once arranged herself under the chandelier, which had a good effect upon her hair. Then she thought better of it and went away to the other end of the room, as if ashamed of the girlish desire to have the first view a propitious one. It so happened that she could not have done a better thing, for Lori came in so quietly she did not hear him, and as she stood at the distant window with her head half turned and one hand gathering up her dress, the slender white figure against the red curtains was as effective as a well-placed statue. "Good evening, Diana," said Lori, with the look of satisfaction she liked to see in his eyes when they rested on her.
"Good evening, Apollo," she answered, smiling back at him, for he too looked unusually debonair, and the thought of entering the ballroom on the arm of such a personable man caused Amy to pity the four plain Mrs. Davis from the bottom of her heart.
"Here are your flowers. I arranged them myself, remembering that you didn't like what Hannah calls a sot bouquet," said Lori, handing her a delicate nosegay in a holder that she had long coveted as she daily passed it in Cardelia's window.
"How kind you are," she exclaimed gratefully. "If I'd known you were coming, I'd have had something ready for you today, though not as pretty as this, I'm afraid."
"Thank you. It isn't what it should be, but you have improved it," he added, as she snapped the silver bracelet on her wrist.
"Please don't."
"I thought you liked that sort of thing."
"Not from you. It doesn't sound natural, and I like your old bluntness better."
"I'm glad of it," he answered with a look of relief, then buttoned her gloves for her and asked if his tie was straight, just as he used to do when they went to parties together at home. The company assembled in the long salle à manger that evening was such as one sees nowhere but on the continent. The hospitable Americans had invited every acquaintance they had in Nice, and having no prejudice against titles, secured a few to add luster to their Christmas ball. A Russian prince condescended to sit in a corner for an hour and talk with a massive lady, dressed like Hamlet's mother, in black velvet with a pearl bridle under her chin. A Polish count, aged 18, devoted himself to the ladies, who pronounced him a fascinating dear, and a German serene something, having come to supper alone, roamed vaguely about, seeking what he might devour. Baron Rothschild's private secretary, a large-nosed Jew in tight boots, affably beamed upon the world, as if his master's name crowned him with a golden halo. A stout Frenchman, who knew the Emperor, came to indulge his mania for dancing, and Lady de Jones, a British matron, adorned the scene with her little family of eight. Of course, there were many light-footed, shrill-voiced American girls, handsome, lifeless-looking English ditto, and a few plain but piquant French demoiselles, likewise the usual set of traveling young gentlemen who disported themselves gaily, while mamas of all nations lined the walls and smiled upon them benignly when they danced with their daughters. Any young girl can imagine Amy's state of mind when she took the stage that night, leaning on Lori's arm. She knew she looked well. She loved to dance. She felt that her foot was on her native heath in a ballroom and enjoyed the delightful sense of power which comes when young girls first discover the new and lovely kingdom they are born to rule,
by virtue of beauty, youth, and womanhood. She did pity the Davis girls, who were awkward, plain, and destitute of escort, except a grim papa and three grimmer maiden aunts, and she bowed to them in her friendliest manner as she passed, which was good of her, as it permitted them to see her dress, and burn with curiosity to know who her distinguished-looking friend might be. With the first burst of the band, Amy's color rose, her eyes began to sparkle, and her feet to tap the floor impatiently, for she danced well and wanted Lori to know it. Therefore, the shock she received can better be imagined than described, when he said, in a perfectly tranquil tone, "Do you care to dance?"
"One usually does at a ball."
Her amazed look and quick answer caused Lori to repair his error as fast as possible.
"I meant the first dance. May I have the honor?"
"I can give you one if I put off the count. He dances divinely, but he will excuse me, as you are an old friend," said Amy, hoping that the name would have a good effect and show Lori that she was not to be trifled with.
"Nice little boy, but rather a short pole to support. A daughter of the gods, divinely tall and most divinely fair," was all the satisfaction she got, however.
The set in which they found themselves was composed of English, and Amy was compelled to walk decorously through a cotillion, feeling all the while as if she could dance the tarantella with relish. Lori resigned her to the nice little boy and went to do his duty to Flo, without securing Amy for the joys to come, which reprehensible want of forethought was properly punished, for she immediately engaged herself till supper, meaning to relent if he then gave any signs penitence. She showed him her ball book with demure satisfaction, when he strolled instead of rushed up to claim her for the next, a glorious polka redowa. But his polite regrets didn't impose upon her, and when she galloped away with the count, she saw Lori sit down by her aunt with an actual expression of relief. That was unpardonable, and Amy took no more notice of him for a long while, except a word now and then when she came to her chaperone between the dances for a necessary pin or a moment's rest. Her anger had a good effect, however, for she hid it under a smiling face and seemed unusually blithe and brilliant. Lori's eyes followed her with pleasure, for she neither romped nor sauntered, but danced with spirit and grace, making the delightsome pastime what it should be. He very naturally fell to studying her from this new point of view, and before the evening was half over, had declared that little Amy was going to make a very charming woman. It was a lively scene, for soon the spirit of the social season took possession of everyone, and Christmas merriment made all faces shine, hearts happy, and heels light. The musicians fiddled, tooted, and banged as if they enjoyed it. Everybody danced who could, and those who couldn't admired their neighbors with uncommon warmth. The air was dark with Davises, and many Jones gambolled like a flock of young giraffes. The golden secretary darted through the room like a meteor, with a dashing Frenchwoman who carpeted the floor with her pink satin train. The serene Teuton found the supper table and was happy, eating steadily through the bill of fare, and dismayed the garçons by the ravages he committed. But the emperor's friend covered himself with glory, for he danced everything, whether he knew it or not, and introduced impromptu pirouettes when the figures bewildered him. The boyish abandon of that stout man was charming to behold, for though he carried weight, he danced like an India rubber ball. He ran, he flew, he pranced, his face glowed, his bald head shone, his coattails waved wildly, his pumps actually twinkled in the air, and when the music stopped, he wiped the drops from his brow and beamed upon his fellow men like a French Pickwick without glasses. Amy and her pole distinguished themselves by equal enthusiasm, but more graceful agility.